Welcome back to Cairo Nights.
Yeah, finally
calmed myself down after all that airplane engine discussion. It makes me nervous. It shouldn't. I know. Logically, it shouldn't bother me at all. I'm still going to fly wherever I want to when we can all start doing that again. It's never going to stop me from traveling, but it is always going to keep me at least popping by the airport bar on my way to the flight. Heidi Gruber in the Seattle Times did a terrific story today that is counterintuitive, I think, for a lot of us, given what the economy is and given the way the city has reacted to the coronavirus. And the story is titled, is in headline this: Seattle's among the top markets as U.S. home prices increased by double digit percentages for the first time in years. And her story starts off with, here's one more sign that Seattle's housing market bounced back from the coronavirus pandemic before 2020 was over. At least if you're a seller in December, home prices in the Seattle area continued to rise faster than the national average. They were up 13.6%. Now, does this make a whole lot of sense to you? Because it certainly doesn't to me. I mean, the story certainly makes sense logically, and it's well reported. But I don't really get it that, and I don't know that they ever actually dropped, candidly. I didn't see any indication when I look at Zillow or Redfin data that at any point in the pandemic, I mean, it's been a year now, that at any point in the pandemic, housing prices ever dropped. What has happened is apartment prices have dropped radically. That is a massive, I think, help to the economy, certain for people on the lower end of the economic or the middle end of the economic spectrum, people who are renting, because you see now deals all over town. 2 months free, free this, free parking, whatever you want. They are offering it right now. If you are an apartment hunter and you have not clued into this, take a look around. On half the apartment complexes in Seattle, you're going to start seeing now renting signs popping up, and they're going to start offering deals. So that makes some sense, because a lot of the people who are working in jobs that maybe didn't continue during the pandemic, a lot of folks living in apartments, and folks who were living in apartments but maybe living, they'd moved here away from home, now are finding themselves in a remote work environment, and they're moving somewhere else cheaper because they can live anywhere they want. All of those things seem to contribute to a fairly sizable vacancy rate in apartments, some of the best I've seen since I've been in Seattle. But the housing prices, the people buying houses, it's not like some people seem to move away, it's not like the money fled town, clearly, because housing prices are, like you just heard, they are not only going up, they're beating the national average. And what I'm still curious about is, all right, if people are having the opportunity to move away, perhaps what's happening is folks are hanging on to their Seattle house, moving away and renting that house out, which, of course, is they're going to get an upside on what they are possibly paying, maybe the difference between what they're renting or purchasing and their existing mortgage. On the other hand, rents in Seattle are getting cheaper and cheaper, so they won't be able to rent that house for a top dollar as they once would have been able to. And so that could be it. I've heard real estate agents for the past 5 years complaining there is not enough houses on the market to drive the house prices down. In other words, it is absolutely a seller's market. And now we're getting in that situation again. Whenever you see those 8%, 10%, 13% housing price increases, you know that that's when the upbidding starts. And the upbidding is that situation where someone offers a price and then you have to show up with $50,000, $75,000 more in cash to be able to make that house yours. And so we're going to try and dig in a little bit this week and figure out, why is there this discrepancy between an economy that is far worse off and yet a housing market that is not? And part of it also may be that we're not building as many houses as we used to. We're building many more apartments. But then you also have this. One of our frequent reporters here. We depend on him a lot for the quality of his stories and the fact that he's a fun guy to get on air. Gene Balkin, he's not here today with us, but his story is headlined this. And this is what I'm saying. This is the part that makes it confusing about the housing prices. People aren't fleeing Seattle. They just aren't moving here anymore. And so his story says this, to read from his story. According to countless news sources, a lot of folks are kissing city life goodbye and moving to the open spaces of the suburbs or even more rural parts of the country. The rise of remote work since the start of the pandemic is enabling these moves. Yet, you can find evidence that seems to back up this idea. If you're looking for it, there are polls showing that urban dwellers are contemplating a change of scenery. City folks are spending more time than ever drooling over online real estate listings in far off locales. But here in Seattle, rents have nosedived. And this is odd. There's a new report that shows According to migration data, people are not, in fact, actually seeing fleeing cities, not yet anyway. There's been an uptick in a number of people leaving urban neighborhoods in Seattle, in most of the large metro areas, but it isn't anywhere near what you would describe as an exodus. But that's not the whole story. The bigger part of the story is it doesn't mean Seattle's doing just fine. People have actually stopped moving here as well. Now, there is a part of me that thinks, well, if fewer people move here, as much as I, you know, want businesses to do well in Seattle, I don't know that I find that that's not something that personally gives me heartache. I do understand that if you're in a business that depends on increasing numbers of people to move to Seattle, I get it. It's a reason to be worried. For me, I think that that's a quality of life thing that doesn't always coincide with rapid growth. And I feel like that sometimes from a city leader standpoint, not necessarily referring to Jenny Durkin specifically, I think all city leaders, they sort of get caught up in this idea that fastest growing city in America is a great thing. And Seattle was that for many years. I don't think that I think that comes with enormous pain points. And I'm not sure that the pain points are a fair trade for the additional taxes that we are generating. But nonetheless, so we're finding that the studies are showing that people are not actually moving into Seattle at that alarming clip that they were when Amazon was on hiring bids and so was everyone else. And we were getting 1,000 people a week or something along those lines. What's happening now is people are just actually staying put, or they're just not moving here, at least according to the data. And so that begs the question, because we were told, and this may well be true, I'm not saying that this is necessarily incorrect data, but we were told that part of the reason that homes had become so expensive here is all these folks are decamping from more expensive cities, from either New York, there's not many anymore, New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles, and they're coming up to Seattle, and that's what's driving all these home prices through the roof, and thus locals can't afford to buy a home here anymore. And all of that was certainly true from an income and house price standpoint. But why then, if we have one story saying that house prices are through the roof and we have another story saying, and it could be that they're using data sets from slightly different periods, we have another story saying that people are not moving here, it feels to me like there's something else out there that is ready to happen. That maybe we are going to get in a situation where that lack of people moving into town is going to start tugging house prices back in a different direction. And that maybe, if you're looking to sell, maybe this is a good time to. Now, please, I am not a financial advisor. I do not even play one on the radio. And I would not take my deep analysis of two sentences at its word. But there does feel to me like those two different things are in, maybe they're not in conflict yet, but at some point they're going to meet and marry, and we're going to have a different situation. And that different situation, I think, likely will be some form of economic leveling off, which will lead to housing price leveling off, and people aren't moving here. All of those things seem to indicate that maybe we'll get to a place where we are not seeing the house prices increase. Now, one of the caveats against that, according to the housing experts that I've spoken with, they always say that because we're rezoning the town rapidly and because we are doing things that are actually adding property value without actually changing the property, when you raise height restrictions, when you allow people to subdivide, that fundamentally will raise your property value because you can put more units on a given plot. And so we've done quite a bit of that in Seattle, and it could be that that is in part what is jacking up the rent. Because remember, if you add enough value to an individual single family home, you don't get another single family looking at that thing. You get speculators as well who want to build townhomes or want to build an ADU or something like that. And those sort of things are possibly why the housing market is increasing. And I would also say that when you have those things, it also puts a premium on individual people who want a house and who don't want to live in a more densely populated environment, who don't want to live in a townhouse, who don't want to live in a condo complex or an apartment complex, and can't afford to get a house with some separation and a yard. And that is still so much kind of this very American idea. I think some people have stepped away from that. Certainly urban dwellers have to some degree, and other people are really, really clinging to it. And this has been the source of many fights in city council regarding what neighborhoods we rezone, upzone, as they like to say, and what neighborhoods we don't. Remember, Minneapolis last year took the unusual move of essentially eliminating single-family house zoning everywhere in the city. And that's going to really remap that city. And there are people, housing advocates, who say that's the way you fight these high housing prices in Seattle, regardless of the reason. We know that if we increase the supply, generally speaking, the prices go down. Although we increase the supply a lot over the last few years and increase the density, and it didn't seem to have that effect on making the city more affordable. But maybe we've turned the corner on that now, at least from an apartment standpoint. The other big thing that we're going to have to ask ourselves is, well, what is going to happen when these companies decide, some of them will, some of them won't, when they decide, man, we want you back in the office place, at least some of you. And clearly some companies are going to do that. I mean, the big law firms, they tend to function with a lot of people in the in-house because they like to have those sort of conversations and those meetings that they feel like are necessary to have, you know, when you can walk into someone else's office and get some advice or get some help on a case. At least that's the way it's been described to me. Is Amazon going to go back to having workers in its, a few million feet of office space in Seattle? My guess is yes, although it's a company hitting record profits without having those people in the buildings. And so I guess it's an open question who is going to go back and who isn't, and whether or not they are going to adjust pay rates accordingly as a result of that. So some of that is going to dictate what people do and when people come here, because there's a lot of people, I'm guessing. I have a couple friends who have done this, not with Amazon, with other companies, who have accepted jobs that normally would have involved a transcontinental move, and they're not doing it. I mean, they have been told by their companies, we're not even worried about that right now. Let's get through this, and maybe we'll work out an arrangement where you split your time between the two places, or maybe we won't have you come out at all. We'll see how it goes. And so we could be entering a new territory where none of these numbers are going to make a whole lot of sense moving ahead. And we've got one more item on this. And this, I got to say, if you've been listening to the show, you know that one of the things that I am really profoundly interested in is the internet, our interaction with the internet, but on the myriad of things that stem from it, from the whole idea of, you know, how the internet affected, how social media affected things like the Capitol riot, things like teen anxiety, things like actual adult friendships and commerce and all of that. But one of the other areas that we spend a lot of time talking about, of course, is internet privacy. This is the load bearing pillar in the Washington State's attorney general and other states suing Facebook over its essential abuse, it says, of privacy laws, of scraping all of your data, not telling you what they're doing with it, certainly not paying you for this data. And in fact, you're embracing its product. You are providing it its product for free. And should we have more rights to our data? A lot of tech companies would say no, but some states are passing laws and looking at laws that actually would require at least a permission, if not an outright payment. Illinois is one of these states. The headline of the story says it all. The best new law you've never heard of. Taking back control of our personal data can feel like a lost cause, but there's hope. And they actually even use an exclamation point on this, which is what got my attention, of course. So what is this law about? All right. Well, so you are probably frustrated with the fact, or maybe you're not. I don't know. Maybe you don't care, but I do. The idea that we are providing, that we are the product. When you go on a free website, when you go on Google, which is free, largely, when you go on Facebook, which is free, largely, you are actually not a customer using a product. You are the product in that particular case. It's something you're all probably pretty familiar with, because Facebook built its entire business model on scraping every bit of your data, not just your data while you're on Facebook. Remember, this is the problem of their dispute with Apple. Facebook wants your data the entire time you are online and sets up its program to do exactly that. Well, now, a few years ago, Illinois approved something that turned out to be a really prescient law. It's called this, the Biometric Information Privacy Act of Illinois, or BIPA. It's considered one of the toughest privacy laws in the United States. It passed in 2008, and it was before most of us had smartphones. We certainly didn't have facial recognition and fingerprint sensors and all of the stuff that has come since then. But here's what it does. And of course, this only applies to Illinois residents. It requires companies to actually tell you when it's using your biometric data. So let me read you from the story. It says, companies behind the technologies like voice assistant or photo recognition services can't use people's biometric details without their knowledge or consent. There's almost no American privacy laws that go this far, and it's very difficult to get them that far because of obviously a tremendous amount of financial money looking to prevent that. So we would have to, this is a little bit, it touches on a law you may have heard passed in California that essentially means that you have rights to your data. Your data is your possession, and companies can't just take that and sell it in the way that Google now does and the way that Facebook does now, and Instagram, which is a Facebook company. And a lot of these little apps that you use, these third party apps, many of them are not even there as much to give you, they're giving you an app, right? They're giving you an app to use, and maybe you're doing something small with it, but it's really there to just put a syringe in and pull out some discrete bit of data that it can then market to somebody else. Now, Apple has taken a relatively strong stand against this, and Apple's new dust up with Facebook and other companies actually is essentially this thing. All Apple has done on its new operating system is say, we are going to give people a warning. When third-party apps decide to grab their data and offer it up, they're going to know whether or not they want to participate in that. Now, Facebook has gone ballistic trying to fight this because that's Facebook's whole business model. And it put out these ads saying Apple's trying to hurt small businesses, you know, advertise effectively, blah, blah. No, that's not true. I mean, Facebook, it's pretty disingenuous of Facebook to suggest that this sort of data that people, all Apple is doing, remember, it's not saying that you can't. All Apple is doing is saying you should know. And then you can make a decision about it. It's not a terribly outrageous thing, but it was outrageous to Facebook because Facebook has built its entire business model on what you don't know. It is not all the stuff you do now know or think you know from actual Facebook getting onto Facebook. It's all the stuff you don't know that Facebook is doing that really is the core of its business model. Now, the people in technology are saying that this BIPA law is so well written that it's kind of become the gold standard. Now, whether or not this can extend into Washington State, which I think would be friendly towards something like this, although, again, remember who is based here and who has many employees here. I've heard that other states, New Jersey, I think, are thinking about picking up this sort of law and requiring companies to actually tell us when they're using our biometric data. Because remember, you are giving biometric data all the time and you don't realize it. Actually having companies required to warn you that they are collecting your biometric data. Again, a lot of this stuff, people who say they don't have any concern, well, if you don't have any concern, then just check yes. Big deal. For those of us who do have some concern, I may still check yes, but I would just like to know. And that's what we're talking about sometimes with this data. We're not trying to limit companies' ability to do this, especially if they're not doing harmful stuff. Although I think there's a pretty good argument about maybe we should just limit their ability to do it at all. But let's set that aside. What we're simply asking is, hey, if you're going to be using us, tell us. Simple. I don't see how that is something so outrageous that we can't all immediately get behind. All right, coming up, Rachel Bell. How many refrigerators do you have? If it's only one, turns out you may be in the minority. Right after the break. Just the other day, Rachel, I was needing to grab some additional stuff out of, we have got this kind of smallish Euro fridge in our kitchen, and I was going to have to head downstairs, get something out of the little tiny, like, college fridge we have down there. And I was talking with it, like, just the whole the ridiculousness of having two fridges. And then you send a story along, and apparently, I am not alone. Apparently, this is a thing.
So not alone. Okay, this is such a random story in the New York Times about people who have more than one refrigerator, which only the New York Times can drag this out to a very long article.
Exactly.
Loved every word of it, could I say that? So I'm going to start with a lot of numbers, just because all of these numbers just shocked me. Around 35 million U.S. households have two refrigerators. How is that possible? And then 6 million households in this country have more than two refrigerators. This comes from actually, strangely, a federal agency, the Energy Information Administration, who keeps track of such things. So they broke it down even more. So people who make a lot more money, like over $140,000, are the most likely to have a fridge. But then it's even broken down by race and culture. So people of color also have second refrigerators and disproportionately high rates. It said nearly 20% of Black Americans have more than one, 22% of Latinos, 23% of Asian Americans, and a third of Native Americans who responded to this survey have more than one fridge. They told a story of this family where the parents live in one house and then the adult child lives next door with her partner. There's five people total. They have five fridges total, one for each person.
Wow.
And then, of course, when the pandemic started, people, just as they were hoarding toilet paper, started, you know, prepping, and people started buying freezers for their garage. And then when those completely sold out, they turned to refrigerators, which kind of doesn't make sense because, you know, in a huge disaster, there probably wouldn't be power. But anyway, that's how the story goes. So this just fascinated me because when I was a kid, I remember really wanting a second fridge in the garage because the few friends that I knew who had one, the fridge was full of junk food that my parents wouldn't buy. And so my tiny little bird brain child mind thought that if we had a second fridge, it would be full of soda and frozen corn dogs and pizza rolls and all of these things that I wasn't allowed to have.
And bagel dogs.
And, oh, yeah, we had bagel dogs, of course.
You did.
My family's company.
So I was thinking,
right?
I was, oh, yeah, yeah, no, no, that's why I brought it up. The,
okay.
So the thing about the extra fridge, though, it seemed to me when I was reading the story as well, that I bet there's a correlation between the number of households that had those and the rise of the big box stores. Because you buy in, I mean, for example, if you go to Costco, especially if you like two people in my household and Vern, who's probably almost half a person, he's such a big cat. And then you have one person and one cat, correct, in your household. So not a need for like extra, you don't need to buy. But the fact is that if you do go to these stores or some other stores sell in these large containers now, that you feel like, all right, well, I can buy more in bulk. I can save a little bit of money, but you can clutter up, especially if you're in, you have just one fridge, you can clutter that up really quickly with stuff you're not moving through. And I bet that the big box stores had a lot to do with the expansion of a fridge and a freezer, you know, in every garage.
Well, yeah, it's a huge reflection on American culture because still in a lot of places of Europe, in Europe, people shop daily. You know, there's still a lot of places, even in Paris. I was speaking to a woman in Paris this week who said, you know, I go still to a butcher and then I go to the bakery and I go to the cheesemonger. And a lot of people still shop, you know, just for the meal they're making that day or maybe the next day. But in this culture, yeah, we go to Costco and we fill the fridge and we buy a lot of processed foods and we fill them. We fill the fridge with that. And it's kind of the same as like when I have a small purse, I only need a small purse. I put a few things in it. But when I have a big purse, I fill it up with like who knows what, you know? So I think it's the same. Like the more room you give yourself, the more you start to fill it. Because in this story, there's like an example of this woman who in her garage fridge only ever has, you know, a six pack or two of ginger ale. But she says, well, I just like knowing that it's in there just in case. So I think that Americans are like, even if you're not a full-on prepper, we're still kind of preppers compared to Europeans.
Well, yeah. I mean, that is part of that. The whole idea that what if, you know, what if a group of friends suddenly drops over? I'll have plenty of stuff and I won't have to go to the store that's four blocks away after they get here. It is a little bit like that. I mean, we own a bar, and why we have like a fridge full of beer at home, I have no idea. I mean, we buy a lot, thousands of dollars in beer. We do not need to have any at home. But, you know, we get these samples or you buy some or you have friends over, friends bring it over when they come over and whatever. And then you get, and then pretty soon you're thinking like, man, I could use an extra fridge. And we have got this little kind of downstairs, it's kind of half apartment, half basement room, but it's got its own entrance and its own bathroom and things like that. And of course, because people sometimes will stay there, we put a fridge in. So we are actually one of the two fridge people. We've got a little tiny sort of like, you know, dorm fridge down there. And then we've got our sort of almost regular sized fridge upstairs. I was, as soon as I read the story, like, man, we're one of those people too.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were some interesting cases that make sense, you know, culturally, people who hunt and fish, you know, they obviously like
makes sense
have
then,
a
right.
lot of meat and fish. And then they were even talking about, you know, if you're Korean and you make a lot of your own kimchi, where are you going to put that? Or if you make your own sausages, you have to have a place for that. And so I kind of felt a little more forgiving of those. I thought those were a little bit cooler than just, you know, the second, third, because some of these people have three fridges, just, you know, suburban people.
Well,
I think, you know, once you move away, when you can't, like, I can walk to the supermarket. And so I think that's probably why I tend to not bulk up quite as much.
I would also say, though, that I'm surprised that as families have gotten, well, maybe I'm not. I did offer up the big box store theory, but counter to that would be that families are actually getting smaller. I mean, when I was a kid, it wasn't unusual for a family to have three kids or four kids or five kids, especially if you're in Catholic school, right? But so almost everyone you knew, if you walked into a house, like the garbage was going to be underneath the sink and the foil was going to be in the junk drawer, was like everyone kind of organizes the same way. And you knew if it had an attached garage, that they were going to have a fridge there. You just knew, like everyone did. It was as standard as the fridge in the kitchen nearly. But that was, I always felt it was because there was a lot of people in the household, like five people in a household. You kind of need two fridges maybe.
Well, that's the fact I forgot to bring up at the beginning. It says that the households with two occupants lead in two fridge ownership. So it isn't a
crazy
family thing. Yeah, it is. People with two people living in the house have the likeliest. Yeah, they're going to have a second fridge. So yeah, if you have a second fridge and you're listening, or if you have more, like I want to hear from people who have a crazy amount of fridges. So text us 98973. If you have more than two fridges, more than three fridges, I want to know who has the most fridges.
And also time for a quick plug for the podcast, if you want.
Yes. So my podcast, Your Last Meal, is celebrating 100 episodes this Thursday, February 25th. So if you want to get the episode right away, make sure you're subscribed. But usually I interview celebrities. This time, because it's 100, I decided to interview three 100-year-old people. And when I say people, I mean women, because the women are the only ones left at that age.
Right.
But it is a wonderful episode. They're actually all from the Seattle area. They all had really interesting lives. And then I speak with IKEA about the history of Swedish meatballs. And I speak with someone who does a podcast about eating alone, because so many people are eating alone right now. And that's something that, you know, we're not all enjoying.
That sounds fantastic.
A lot of podcasts coming your way on Thursday.
All right. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the random question robot right after the break. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Cairo Nights. We are prepared. It's my first day back after missing, I think, Friday and Monday. I don't think that I know that. And, of course, I missed the weekend, but then we all did. So I am even more ill-prepared than normal to answer questions. However, it's in my contract. I cannot avoid this. So I assume both of you are readier than I am.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty ready.
Not that much.
All right, then. Here we go.
Let's go.
Question one.
All right, this one's for you, Frank. What was the name of your first crush?
My first crush. Gosh, that would be when I was a kid. And I'm going to need another minute for this one. That's a real stumper. Let me think.
Okay, Mike, you got one?
Probably, yeah, I think I remember. My sister is 2 years older than me. I think when I was like, when she was in kindergarten, so I was 3 or 4 at the time, she had a friend named Robin who was really nice to me. And immediately I just like that. This is great. I really like Robin. So I guess it was Robin.
Oh, Robin. That's a beautiful name. Frank, what do you got?
I think it was a girl named Tracy Trapp, but I can't tell you anything about her other than she was a brunette.
That's a really concerning last name, Trapp.
No,
yeah, that's a very concerning last name.
Two piece.
Well, I know mine. This girl's name was Kelly. I was big into her from probably about kindergarten through the third grade. And I got her Valentine's Day gifts every single year at school. And then I also told her that I was going to write her a country album one day. Did any of that happen? Not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. All right, next
question. Still have time.
Huh?
Yeah.
You never know.
It's not over yet.
All right, Mike, this question is for you. Which day do you think starts the week? Is it Sunday or is it Monday?
Wednesday. Absolutely. I don't think there's any question that Wednesday starts. That's when you start panicking about the stuff you need to get done this week. That's when it really kicks into high gear. This Monday, Tuesday, they're the on-ramp. Mm. Wednesday is when you really floored it and started sliding over to the fast lane. And then by Friday, you're looking for the next exit. So I would say Wednesday.
Okay, Frank.
I'm a Sunday kind of guy. I just think of the week starting, and it probably is because it's the day that I draw. So I have deadlines, and that's sort of my last gasp. I have to get it done by Sunday night, or I'm screwed the next day. So, yeah, Sunday.
Sunday. I'm going to go with Monday. I really think that Monday really is just the pinnacle. Like, everybody knows that Monday is the start of the week. That's when the work week starts. Sunday I could get behind because it's a nice, easy way into your week, but we all know that the real week starts on Monday. We got things to do. All right. I think we got one more here. All right. This one is me. What would be on a gag reel of your life? I think a good gag reel that would be, or something that happened to me that would be in a gag reel of my life, is getting pantsed in front of my PE class in the sixth grade. I feel like that was a terrifying enough moment, but a funny enough moment that I feel like it would fit perfectly in a really good gag reel. That's the one that first comes to my mind. Mike, what do you got?
I would say that it might actually happen to me as an adult and as a reporter. I would say that it was when I was in Yakima. I had to go to Eastern Washington to cover mad cow disease, which was discovered in Mabton,
right?
In Mabton, Washington, and it was an ice storm. I literally put my truck in four-wheel drive in Seattle because it was snowing in Seattle, and had it in there for the whole 7 hours to get out there. I've never hit a patch of road that wasn't icy. So I'm in Yakima after I finished my reporting, and I'm walking past a restaurant trying to find an entrance, because I'm starved. I haven't eaten all day. And I hit a patch of ice on the sidewalk. And I'm right in front of the restaurant's about half a block long. It's all plate windows. The place is packed. And I start to slip and catch myself. And then start to slip again. And I slip and catch myself for, I don't know, almost all the way to the end of the block, and I think I finally have saved it, and finally one last, like, dramatic, complete legs out, straight onto my back, just a crushing fall, and I heard cheers in the restaurant, because people had been watching me fall for, like, a good 15 seconds before I finally went down.
I bet some of them put some money on it when you were...
I'm sure they did. I would have if I were them. I wouldn't have blamed them for a moment.
Frank, what do you got?
Well, I told the story in the air before. I won't go into the great details other than it was the first time I ever went drinking illegally as a kid. I was a freshman in high school, and we were out in the woods by Tahuya. And I drank to excess, and I was the only person picked up. It was my one and only trip in a police car ever. And my dad was a relatively successful attorney in Kitsap County. And so I remember sitting in the front seat. They didn't put me in the back. They put me in the front seat. And I remember reaching for the shotgun that was, you know, oh, nice gun. And don't touch that. And then I remember the radio call, which was that the deputy called the home office and said, hey, you'll never guess who I've got in the car. So, yeah, that would probably be it.
And that is the difference when you grow up with your dad as a prominent attorney.
Yes, that is.
You're right in the front seat.
A white.
And not the back seat.
Correct.
Absolutely. All right, that looks like it's all the robots got for us today.
All right, folks, thank you for joining us once again for the Random Question Robot. Coming up, big conversation with Stacey. You've heard probably the news about the Mariners. If you haven't, oh, you're going to get an earful. And what she thinks and what I think about the Mariners' decision to make some management changes as a result of just a little conversation with the Rotary Club in Bellevue.
The CEO and president.
Whew, that was a doozy.